This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
I'd like to welcome you. I'm Paul Newton from the Cambridge Assessment Network Division, and this is a seminar in our current issues and assessment series. Okay, well, I'm very pleased to be able to welcome and to introduce today our speakers. Our speakers are Graham Hudson, Beth Black, and Tom Benton. Graham is Director of Electronic Assessment at the Data Capture Specialists, DRS. He's had more than 25 years of experience of leading and managing, implementing educational assessments in different organisations, including QCA and AEB. Beth was recently appointed to Senior Manager in the Research and Technical Standards bit of OCR, although she was previously a Senior Research Officer in the Research Division of Cambridge Assessment. And as well as being a senior research officer, Beth's also been a deputy chair of examiners for OCR, and one of her most recent triumphs was the publication of a book called The A to Z of Critical Thinking, which was published through Continuum. Finally, Tom is a senior statistician at the National Foundation for Educational Research, and he's also a member of the Royal Statistical Society. Tom's got a very broad portfolio of expertise in statistics, from multi-level modelling to structural equation modelling, item response modelling, and many, many more, I believe. Together they represent a formidable team, and today they're going to lead us through the state-of-the-art introduction to approaches to monitoring marking quality through electronic assessment. And the structure for today's session is going to be Beth kicking off the presentation, and that's going to lead seamlessly into Tom's presentation, and then we're going to finish with Graham's. So I'd like to hand over first of all to Beth. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Okay, effective monitoring of marking quality with on-screen marking. So just a little outline of my talk. I'm going to talk a little bit about what we mean by effective monitoring. I'll talk a bit about how things were and are in paper-based system of monitoring, and then move on to some of the possibilities of monitoring in an online environment. Really what I'm doing is just a bit of scene setting, and I'm just the warm-up act for these two guys here. So yes, I've got a much more sort of superficial approach. Okay, so effective monitoring, what is it? If we think about any sort of diagnostic tool, let's say for mental illness or physical ailments, or if we're trying to identify normal people versus terrorists, we could talk about the sort of diagnosis and whether they're negative, so they're not a terrorist, they don't have this physical ailment, or positive. And in the case of what we're interested in here today, we're talking about a positive ID being that of an aberrant examiner, someone who we're not confident in their ability to mark. We could look at it in terms of this sort of grid. Some of you, I'm sure, are familiar with this type of thing. So true positive is saying we've diagnosed them as being an aberrant marker, and they actually are an aberrant marker. Okay? They really are an aberrant marker. Whereas the majority of our population are going to be fine markers, you know, they're not going to be get flagged by our systems, and they really are, in actuality, a fine marker. But the challenge for any sort of diagnostic tool is making sure that we don't have these kind of false positives or false negatives. So false positive would mean that we've said they're an aberrant marker, but in fact they're okay. We wouldn't want to do that. We wouldn't want to stop somebody from marking who's actually a decent marker. And equally, we don't want any false negatives. So we don't want to decide that somebody is a decent marker when in fact they're aberrant and we should be stopping them from marking. So the challenge in any model, and what we're talking about today, is in minimising our false positives and negatives and getting a true, you know, hold on these true positives, these aberrant markers. I'm not really going to talk about, you know, strategies for dealing with aberrant markers, because that's sort of beyond the scope of this. Really, we're interested in the sort of diagnostic mechanisms, the monitoring, the quality assurance of identifying these markers. Okay. So let's just turn our minds back to paper-based marking and where we were at with that. So there was a standardisation, people you know, markers pass the standardisation, and then we sample them through batch one and batch two. This is a typical model. It wasn't the, you know, wasn't and isn't the model in every paper-based marking model in the UK, but it's certainly the model in OCR. So in batch one and batch two, assistant examiners send about 20% of their marking allocation to their team leader, TL, from which the team leader will select 10 scripts and then remark them. And the agreement that we mainly look at is at script level, you know, on the whole script overall as the marker, you know, pretty much coming into line with what the TL gave it. The tolerance that's applied, you know, the sort of criteria that we apply to decide whether an assistant examiner is in or out is applied pretty much at script level in all these models. And then marking review. So this is sort of post the main period of marking. An assistant examiner scripts would only really be pulled up if there were a lingering doubt, if there was some sort of uncertainty about them. And at that point, they might have another 10 or 20 additional scripts sampled from their allocation to then make the decision about whether they're an aberrant examiner or not. So I'm sure many of you are familiar with that. So we'll just talk a bit about the implications of what happened in paper-based marking. The first one was something that always slightly concerned me when I was a team leader and principal examiner, etc., was that the assistant examiners had responsibility for the primary selection of scripts. So if you had a suspicious mind, like I have, you'd worry that there are some examiners out there who might sort of think, I'll send these off because I think I've done a good job on these. And the ones I'm not so sure about, I might send back to the warehouse. I mean, I'm sure people don't do that. But something to think about. And because it's gone back to the warehouse, the majority of their marking allocation isn't easily open scrutiny. I'm not saying it's not open scrutiny, but it's not easily open scrutiny because we have this sort of physical issue of shifting scripts around and requesting scripts and so on and so forth. So it's quite an inflexible model. And the other issue, I think, in the paper-based marking monitoring is this sort of double subjectivity. So the assistant examiner marks the scripts in the first place, and then the team leader remarks it while they can see the marks that the assistant examiner has already given. And so it might bring in this sort of, you know, can I live with this mark, or I can see why they've given it this mark. And it's sort of perhaps a little bit too much subjectivity in that model. And finally, final implication is that the sort of script level outcomes, the agreement, sort of trumps the item level agreement or lack of agreement. So it's not as sort of granular, to use a common phrase these days, it's not as fine-grained, it's not as, you know, smart as something that we might be able to do in online marking, because in paper-based marking, we're still really looking at overall, does the whole script mark hold? OK, so in online marking then, we've got many more potentials. So we can have seeding scripts or seeding items at question level, item level, which have been pre-marked by senior examiners, and the definitive marks or the gold standard marks have been set on these seeding items. And I think all UK awarding bodies use a system of seeding scripts or items in their online systems. And these seeding items are then marked blind by assistant examiners. They don't know that these are seeding items. They just treat them like a normal part of their live, normal marking allocation. There's also the potential and scope for feedback throughout the marking period. So team leaders can say, this seeding item's very good. Well done. Carry on how you are. That's great. Or they can say, you know, watch out what you're doing on, you know, question eight because you missed, you know, this credit-worthy material, blah, blah, blah. And it's worth bearing that in mind because any data that we get on the marker's performance may or may not have been affected by this feedback. But we also have a mechanism by which we can help keep markers from becoming aberrant. Okay, in the online marking system, the team leader has much easier access to all of their assistant examiner scripts. So that means they can go sort of poking around, having a good rummage around to see what they're doing. So there's more visibility there. It's possible in some systems to deploy for assistant examiners daily hurdles or qualification exercises. So this would mean if I'm marking on a biology unit and I switch on my computer in the morning and I say I'm going to mark questions 3, 4, and 5, I've got to pass a little test on questions 3, 4, and 5 that checks my marking before I can mark my live marking that day. So you have to qualify, not just in standardisation, but every single day, with the potential for some lockouts, and that's a system that AQA employs. And they can be let back in when they've had the due conversation with their team leader. Okay, some other potentials then. The data accumulates throughout the whole marking period. So in paper-based marking, it's a bit end-loaded. The marks come in, however much we might plead with examiners to send in results as they go along. The marks are coming in very much at the end of the process. Whereas in online marking, as soon as they mark, it's going on the system. So we've got quite a lot of data, 1 week into marking already. We're collecting data both at script level and at item level, so it's much more fine-grained. And we're collecting data not only on the seeding items and scripts, but on their live scripts as well. We're awash with data. Also, because the live scripts are now distributed on a random or quasi-random method, it means that the data that we're collecting on the examiners about their marking and what marks they're giving to scripts are subject to some statistical techniques which wouldn't have worked in paper-based marking, where the scripts are distributed on by centre and where there are always centre effects, which might mean it undermines any conclusions we might draw about the quality of marking. If they've had a particularly good set of centres, their profile of marking will look different. So in online marking, then, because it's quasi-random, we can assume they've had a random allocation of scripts, and they should have a normal sort of distribution in that respect. Also, because we can shift scripts around easily in an online system, scripts are able to be marked by more than one examiner as a check on marking. Okay, so you can get two examiners and see how close they are together, and this might give you a handle on how good that marker is. And Tom's going to talk about that a bit more in detail in a minute. Okay, so techniques for monitoring then, we could say they fall roughly into two categories. So one is making sense of naturally occurring data on live scripts. Or we can implement active strategies or techniques such as seeding script, seeding items. And then within each of these, we have to make decisions about what data tells us the most about the marker, whole script data or item level data. Okay, so I'm going to just move on to some things that might give us some useful information about how good or bad our examiners are. Some of this work's been developed in ARD by Tom Bramley and Nick Rakes and so on and so forth. So thank you for letting me steal some graphs. So simple indicators. So here we've got markers, 16 markers, and we've got the test score going down the y-axis. And for each marker, we can see the distribution of marks they've given and the median and the mean mark. So the marker that stands out in this case is marker 7, who's coming out as severe. So that could be quite useful to know, that they've given, on average, lower marks than all the other markers, albeit on different scripts. Ogives. We have used ogives in the paper-based system, but because of the new random allocation of scripts in online marking, perhaps they're more robust. So an ogive is a cumulative data distribution. Cumulative mark distribution. So the black line here is the average of all the markers on this particular unit, and the red line is a marker. And because we've got test total along the bottom, because it's to the left of the average, we can see that this marker, which is the same marker that was simulated in the previous graph, is severe. So that would flag up to somebody that we might want to take a close look at. Here's a marker that's using an attenuated mark range, so they're not using the very lowest marks or the very top marks. They're sort of squishing their marks together, and that's because of a steeper slope. And again, this might mean we want to look at this marker in more detail. Cronbach's alpha, we often see Cronbach's alpha on our sort of reliability statistics, but we can also apply them to examiners, because Cronbach's alpha is indicating the covariance between item marks within scripts. So here we've got marker 9, whose Cronbach's alpha is a lot low, although, of course, the y-axis is not complete. But because there's less covariance between item marks within the scripts, we might be a little bit suspicious that this marker is a bit erratic. So perhaps they haven't got to grips with the mark scheme, or they're marking a bit too quickly. So that might be a useful flag. Another one is the running mean for each marker. So as their data is going on the system, as they keep marking, we can plot their mean mark. And this, we would expect this to fall within the average of the other markers within tolerance. And we've got the curved lines represent the overall mean plus or minus 2 standard errors. This marker looks possibly on the generous side, but within tolerance. You know, we still have to apply a sort of criteria. Whatever method we deploy, we still have to apply some sort of criteria to decide whether they're, you know, in or out, you know, in the red blob or the green blob, as it were. This marker is modelled to be severe because they fall clearly outside these tram lines. And this could be modelled not just at script level, but we could run the same sort of graph potentially at item level. Or we could model it rather than data cumulative throughout the marking period. We could just look at the last 20 or 50 scripts, although there are some issues around that too, depending on, you know, what you want to look at. Okay, so looking now to sort of more active strategy. Those are all sort of passive strategies, if you like, naturally occurring data. This is looking at what we might do with seeding data. It's just an example, courtesy of Nick. I don't know how well you can see this, but here we've got they've selected a particular item on a test, so it's question 10, and we've got one marker, and we've got their data on 11 seeding scripts, and the marker is in blue. So we can see on the first seeding script, this marker was plus 1 on the definitive mark, and on the second one, spot on for this particular question, then minus 1, so on and so forth. And then as the marking period is progressing and they're going through the seeding scripts, they're getting dead on. Okay, and then this can be compared against other data, so you can see how realistic it looks. So the mean, the green one is the mean item difference for all the markers on each of these scripts for this particular item. So that gives you quite fine-grained idea of this marker on these particular test items. Now, item level considerations. Something I think that's become more and more apparent as we move into online marking and this paradigm shift is that, you know, we can't treat all questions, all items in exactly the same manner. And a lot of this work comes from some research I did in ARD in collaboration with Vikas on seeding items, where I looked at 5, you know, GCSE and A-level units, and all the data that I'm going to show you next slides come from there. I'm afraid some of the graphs haven't replicated very well in this version of PowerPoint, so they've got chopped at the bottom. So if you just think about some examples of items, these were in the units that were in the study. What kind of marker agreement, what rate of marker agreement could we expect on a type of item like this, where it's sort of ticking? You know, could we expect 100% of markers to give exactly the same mark as that of the definitive mark? I think we could. So, you know, marker agreement would be 100%. And here's another one, sort of select the graph which illustrates distance time. We could expect 100% on this one. This is a sort of more constrained item. I don't you know, name a blood vessel. There's only one answer, although they haven't managed to spell it correctly. But we could probably still expect 100% agreement on something like this, on a very constrained response. Something like this, which is an extended response, although, having said that, the candidate hasn't made the most of the space available. I think it was a 6-mark item. We wouldn't expect the same rate of agreement. So there are features of items which will affect what rates we can realistically expect. One feature of questions, which is very important, is a maximum mark. And there's been lots of work over the years on this, including stuff by Tom Bramley and Nick and Alf Massey. So here we've got maximum mark along the bottom. This is from the same data set of the question, and the percentage of agreement between the marker and the markers and the definitive mark. So you can see on 1-mark items, we're up there on 100%, and it declines according to maximum mark. This doesn't show you how far the difference was out or in what direction, but it just gives you a handle on absolute agreement. So if we're thinking about different types of items, I've classified items according to whether they're objective, constrained, short answer questions, extended response, and in this data set, looked at the effects of item type in this respect. This is, I'm sorry, where my graphs have had a bit of a haircut, but it should be maximum mark along here, as in the last graph. So it's increasing maximum mark. So you can see objective items, regardless of maximum mark, we've got fantastic marker agreements. Constrained, it's declining over the mark range. Short answer questions are lower, have lower marker agreement, and extended response have lower agreement again. The bumpiness is because some of the categories have quite small n. So item type is a powerful predictor of marker agreement, and therefore what we can expect when we're trying to spot aberrant markers. The way in which it's marked... So we've got objectively marked, points-based marked in green, which is, they say a particular thing and it triggers a tick, and a tick equals a point. Or levels-based, which is a sort of beige colour. So that's when you've got these band descriptors, levels descriptors. And broadly speaking, the more open the mark scheme, the lower the agreement across the maximum marks of the items. And if we put these two bits together, so I've got different combinations of item and mark scheme. So here we've got, the tightest objective items and objective mark schemes. And here we've got extended answers and levels-based mark schemes. And we can see, it's really perfect if you get your data to look like this, and it just fell out, so I was very fortunate, that as we move along to the more sort of open types of item and mark scheme, the marker agreement decreases. Or as somebody said to me recently, moving from the London Underground to Star Wars. Anyway. Another predictor, I'll just mention it quickly, thanks to work on apparent marking strategy complexity by Renkasito. This is a very strong way of predicting marker agreements. So simple marking strategies are those where the examiner's just looking for patterns or a particular number or a particular word, and they can go, yes, it's right, no, it's not there, it's wrong. Whereas complex marking in green requires the examiner to evaluate and interpret the responses and make a judgment. So complexly marked items are going to have less marker agreements. And so it's a nice way of splitting up how we think about items and how we might expect marker agreement to look. Now, all of these have been set against the definitive mark. But we just had to sort of just raise a little bit of a query about the definitive mark, perhaps, a bit provocative. And that is the definitive mark the only correct mark out there? There's an issue about who decides the definitive mark. Should it be the principal examiner in isolation? or a team of senior examiners, as is the case in many awarding bodies. But if it's a team, so it's not just subject to, you know, the idiosyncrasies of the PE and their, you know, their good moments and bad moments. If it's a team, there's another sort of issue here, a team of senior examiners, because when a team of examiners get together and they're looking at responses, and any of you who've been in meetings of this type will know what I'm talking about, they look at a response and they might look at a, you know, 5-line response for, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, half an hour, you know, and scrape over all the possible interpretations that this candidate may or may not have intended and how these may or may not possibly fit with the mark scheme. And then finally, come to some consensus on what the definitive mark is. And the problem is that with that is that we're expecting an individual examiner sitting at home at, you know, 8 o'clock on a Saturday night to come up with the same answer in just their normal marking behaviour. And they won't give it the same sort of consideration and won't see these multifaceted aspects of the candidate's 5-line response, possibly. So I think that's some source of the disagreement. I mean, there are some deeper conceptual concerns which one examiner recently expressed to me. And he said that, you know, the common experience of all the examiners off record, well, here we are, it's on record, never mind, is that it's impossible always to have an absolute mark for each answer. And I think he was particularly talking about levels-based response marking. So the definitive mark, it's appropriate for some items. It's appropriate for those which are objective or highly constrained and have correspondent mark schemes. But it's probably not absolutely appropriate for all as a concept. So I think sort of the take-home message is, in any of the, you know, tests that are administered and we're trying to identify these, you know, good and bad markers, you know, we're trying to decide what can we live with on this? What's reasonable to live with? And we might expect absolute agreement on some items, but not all. So, of course, one solution is to have a definitive mark at item level and then tolerance that's also applied at item level. And this tolerance would depend upon features, for example, such as the maximum mark, the type of item, which is, as I said, a very strong predictor, the mark scheme approach, and anything else. So concluding thoughts then, at this point, is here we are in a online marking system. We've got many opportunities here for innovation in our quality control processes. I think really we're just at the beginning of a sort of paradigm shift, and we're only just beginning, let's say, to think about how we can use all of this data. But when we're making decisions about what strategy to use, we've got to think about them being user-friendly, because people sitting in awarding bodies, as I said, you know, we're awash with data, so it's got to be very user-friendly, some sort of dashboard on how your markers are doing, with the data, you know, stats sitting behind. It's got to be timely. I mean, that is one advantage of online marking, is we can get much more data during the live marking period and stop aberrant markers earlier. Efficient use, and Graham's going to talk about that a little bit. But I think the key thing is, whatever strategy we decide upon, what data we're going to collect and look at and crunch, we've got to apply some sort of criteria, which means that, just reminding ourselves of where we were at the beginning, some criteria that's going to, you know, maximise our true positives and true negatives and minimise our false positives and false negatives. And that's a key issue as well. So it's not just which strategy, but what cut scores or thresholds do we apply to this in order for it to help us find the bad eggs. Okay. Thank you.
What I'm going to talk about now is within the sort of active strategies for managing markers and quality control, how can we use empirical analysis and empirical data to make sure that system works in the best way possible? Okay. So these are the sort of strategies we're talking about. We might be talking about qualification. So before starting marking, a marker has to attempt a number of items, give the correct mark, and then they can carry on. It might be seeded data, so every so often, rather than marking a live script, they're marking a seed. They don't know which is which, and they have to, and we monitor whether they're giving the correct marks to these seeded, these pre-marked items. Well, the one I'm mainly going to talk about is double marking. Now, what happens in this situation is that a percentage of scripts are not marked just once, they are marked twice. And markers won't know when they are double marking or when they are being double marked on an item. And then, so they've got two peers reviewing the same item and marking it. If they agree, all well and good. If they disagree, then that item is escalated to a team leader or a senior marker to adjudicate which marker is correct. Okay, that's a way of another way of ensuring quality in marking. But in all of these systems, there's a lot of decisions you have to make. You have to say, how much quality control are we going to have? How many items are going to be in a qualification exercise? How often a marker is going to have to do seeds? How much of their work is going to be peer-reviewed? That's one thing you have to decide. You have to decide, what do we mean as an error? So Beth's been talking about how for some items, it's harder to get the correct mark than for others. If it's a sort of clerical item, you ought to get it all the time. You ought to be within, you know, exactly the right mark. But if it's an open response, it might be a lot harder. What are we going to define as a mistake that needs to be escalated or dealt with? And how many errors is a marker going to be allowed? Is it going to be they are off once on one item, they were meant to give one mark, they gave zero, that's it, they are locked out, no more? Or are we going to allow a certain number of mistakes? Now, we can just use our brains and make reasonable decisions for all these questions. However, there's a lot of data now available on markers, and it may be possible, I think it is possible, to use that data to make even better decisions. And what I'm going to do is try and talk about how we do this. Now, this slide is my key slide, and then after this, it's just me trying to actually do what I'm describing here. But this is the key idea, although there might be different ways of applying it. So you've got a quality assurance system, qualifications, seeding, double marking. You ought to understand just how it works, what happens within that system. You've also got historical data, so you understand, by the types of analysis Beth's been describing, how accurate markers are on different types of items. You ought to be able to bring those two together and give a precise description of what it is your quality assurance system is trying to do. Who is it? What type of marker exactly are we trying to identify and stop from marking? What do we mean by that? Once we've got that in place, we should be able to build a probabilistic model for the behaviour of our quality assurance system in terms of how many errors we expect people to make, where we expect them to make errors. And then once we've got that, we can actually make optimum decisions for our system. OK, now the thing I've got to say is the rest of this talk is just me trying to do it, OK? And the way you try and do it, sort of, is less important than this overall principle that using an empirical and probabilistic approach to these decisions can be more effective than just using common sense. So from now on, it's just me having a go, but the way you have a go at it could differ. You might debate with me about the models I use, my probabilistic model, but the actual main point, I think, is a sound one about using maths and decision theory to try and make the best decisions and optimise system parameters. So is my first example, is percentage double marking. So this is the system. Percentage of each marker's mark of work is peer-reviewed, so marked again by another marker. If they're within tolerance, then okay, otherwise it's escalated. If either marker is out of tolerance with the senior marker, this is after it's been escalated, then the one who is out of tolerance with the senior, and it could potentially be both of them, but usually it's just one, will accrue a penalty point. And then if the number of penalty points they accrue over the marking period exceeds the penalty cap, then they are locked out and stopped from marking. Okay, so we've got three parameters we want to optimise there. Percentage, how much of their marking is going to be peer-reviewed? What are the tolerances going to be? How close do they have to be to each other and to the senior marker for that to be acceptable in terms of marks they award? and how many errors are going to be allowed before they are stopped from marking any further. That's the details of our system. Our aim is to identify poor markers. We want to stop poor markers from marking any further. However, we also want the majority of markers to be able to carry on marking, getting their job done unhindered without any interruption, having to jump through hoops. Now, what we need to do is define exactly what we mean by a poor marker. And for the purposes of this, what we have defined a poor marker as one who is twice as likely as the average marker to accrue a penalty. So they're twice as likely to make a mistake. There are some reasons for that, in that this is based on analysis of seeding data, and you look at which markers historically we've stopped from marking, and it tends to be those who are about twice as likely to fail a seed. So that's sort of where that definition comes from. However, it is a non-empirical decision. You have got to make a decision qualitatively. Who is it that we are trying to identify and trying to stop from taking part in the marking process? So that could be something that was revisited later. But that's the definition that we're going to use next. Analysis of historical data. I'll just move on quickly to this. All we're doing is we're looking at how the probability of accruing a penalty relates to the number of marks on an item. And this line is for the average marker. So for a one-mark item, the probability of accruing a penalty is very, very low. For a two-mark item, it goes up a bit. Now, for a three-mark item, there's a tolerance. They're allowed to be out by one mark, so it goes down again, because they could be allowed to give a mark that's one mark off. And it keeps going up again, and then the tolerance increases again, so it goes down. So you get this relationship between the marks available on an item and the probability of accruing a penalty. This is from historical data. And this is obviously a fairly simple model, doesn't involve all the details of item type, so it could be extended. It's just based on number of marks and the tolerances. So we have that data from historical information on how markers behaved, and we can combine that with our definition of a poor marker, and we can add in now what would be the probability of a poor marker accruing a penalty on any one of these items. And as you see, it's just another line above it. Okay, so now we've got a probabilistic model. We can say for any item, the probability of an average marker accruing a penalty and a poor marker accruing a penalty. Therefore, for any fixed amount of marking, suppose they don't just do one item, suppose they do 100 items, we can work out what is the probability that they'll make one mistake, two mistakes, three mistakes. We can work out the full probability. From that basis, we can identify a penalty cap where the probability of a poor marker exceeding that cap is high and the probability of an average marker exceeding that cap is low. From there, we can then identify how much marking we need to achieve a certain gap between those two probabilities. And then from there, we can actually go right back to the beginning and say, what if we ran the whole thing again with different tolerances? Could we make the whole thing more efficient? That's what I'm going to do. Okay, but that's the map of where we're going. So firstly, defining an optimum penalty cap. So imagine, this is an example, this is real data. Imagine we had 110 mark items have been marked, and we work out what is the probability of a marker making any number of mistakes. So the blue line in here is for the average marker, the red line for the poor marker. And we could work out what penalty cap would be best. So if we were to set the penalty cap at zero, so there would only be allowed one mistake and then they'd be stopped, you can see that both, you know, whether you're a poor marker or an average marker, you're very likely to exceed that penalty cap across 100 items. It's very hard to make 100 items without any discrepancy whatsoever. So that would be useless. It would give us no discrimination between the poor marker and the average marker. Similarly, if we set the penalty cap too high, then, all right, you won't stop any of your average markers. They'll never exceed it, but neither will any of your poor markers. So what you need to do is you need to find a point where there is a big gap between these two lines. And that actually comes, for this example, for 10-mark items at 8. If you've got 100 10-mark items, you set a penalty cap of 8, then your poor marker is very likely to exceed that cap, 85% chance of exceeding that cap. your average marker, very low probability, only a 20% chance of exceeding that cap. So thereby, you've got a sort of optimum area to set your penalty cap. Okay. Now, from there, we know how to choose the best penalty cap. What about choosing the right amount of percentage double marking? Now, what we can do is we could rerun this graph and this process for, if we peer-reviewed 100 items, 200 items, 300 items, for any number, and work out these 2 points. And that's what this graph does. So this is assuming there's a marking load of 500 in total. If we double mark 0, that would be 0 items, and there's no possibility of anyone exceeding any penalty caps. Or we could double mark all 500, and then the difference is much bigger. And we were talking about double marking 20% of that 100, and we got these points here. If we do the same process for every possible percentage of double marking, we can see that the gap between the poor marker and the average marker becomes bigger as we increase the amount of double marking. And if rather than plotting these two probabilities, we plot the gap between them, we can say, okay, suppose we want to have a 50% gap between the probability of a poor marker being stopped and the probability of an average marker being stopped. So that would be like a 75% chance that you catch a poor marker, only a 25% chance of inconveniencing an average marker. And then you could work out what percentage double marking you need, and you could go down and say, okay, I think it comes down to about 9.5% when you do it properly. Or you could say, if I want to be really, really accurate and guarantee catching any of these poor markers, so I have a 90%, then I'll need to double mark 50% or so of my 10 mark items, if there are 500 of them. This graph would obviously change depending upon the marking load, how much marking everyone's doing. If they're doing a lot more double, there's a lot more marking to be done, a smaller percentage of it will need to be double marked for the same level of accuracy. Okay. So, we've talked about how to optimise the penalty cap, how to choose the best level of percentage double marking. Now, what we can do is we can now go back through the whole process. This was based on, if we go way back to the beginning, 10 marks had a tolerance of 2, okay? So the probability of an average marker accruing a penalty was about 6%. It was about 12% for a poor marker. And that led us to a recommended, if we had 500 10-mark items, recommended penalty cap of 4 and percentage double marking of 9.5%. Okay? What if we redid the whole process but with different tolerances? How would that affect the parameters we choose? And what we can actually see here is that if we were to reduce the tolerance from 2 to 1, now that seems very harsh, because you're now expecting markers on a 10-mark item to always be within 1 mark of each other. And indeed, it is quite harsh. The probability of accruing a penalty now goes up a lot for the average marker. It was about 6%. It's now 26%. However, in this system, we can account for that. We can say, OK, it's a lot harder to get to mark these items within tolerance. But however, because it's harder, we're going to allow a higher penalty cap to account for that. And also, once we've done that, we can now have a much smaller amount of percentage double marking. And what we find is that if we reduce the tolerance from 2 to 1, the amount of marking that we need for a 50% marking confidence, that is, having a 50% gap between these two lines, is much smaller. Rather than having to double mark 9.5%, it's only 3.5%. We've almost reduced the amount of peer review that's required by 2/3, but kept the level of accuracy of the system the same. And that's by using our empirical approach, choosing the parameters of the system. So what we're saying here is we're saying it's actually better to have a system that measures, that makes failure more common, We're saying we're going to let examiners fail more seeds or be out of tolerance more often, measure it more often, and allow more mistakes. And if we do that, we actually get a more accurate measurement of marker ability or marker discrepancy from the peer examiner, and it becomes a more accurate system. And we could actually do this for all, across all maximum marks available. So here we did it for a 10-mark item, and just generally speaking, we find that the tolerances we would recommend would be lower than you would generally expect. We'd want to see more mistakes, measure them more often, get a better measurement of marker ability. So the empirical approach is possible and it's working, and it can improve the effectiveness of the system. And it, what it can actually do, which is particularly exciting, is retain the same level of accuracy in terms of identifying markers, but with a much smaller amount of quality assurance. So here's another example. This is one I've thought about a lot less, but I thought it was interesting, which is rather than double marking, what about seeding? Now, with seeds, what we can think of is we tend to think of seeds as being separate from a test. But seeding is itself a test for examiners. Okay? So what we can do is we could actually think of each seed as being an item for a marker. Okay? And then they can either mark it, and if they get it correct, no errors are recorded, or they mark it incorrectly, sort of out of tolerance, and an error is recorded. Once we start thinking of it like this, seeding becomes much more like a standard test development problem, and we know a lot about how to make tests that measure children accurately. So we should be able to bring the same principles to developing a seeding system that measures the quality of markers accurately. And we'd use the same sort of tools that we use in traditional test development. So reliability analysis, item response theory, RASH analysis, those sorts of tools to work out the best parameters for our system. Now, I've actually done this for one item in one biology exam, okay? So I've only done a tiny bit of analysis on this, but there were 43 seeds for this one item. And when I analyse markers using item response theory, the important thing about this is a very typical graph you would get in a test development problem. This is a real piece of data from a seed in a biology exam, and it doesn't actually look very different to what you would get from analysing items within a test for children. So it works in much the same way. But rather than measuring pupil ability and their score, we're measuring marker inaccuracy or their discrepancy from the principal examiner and their expected seed discrepancy, how many marks away they are on a seed. Now, once we look at it this way, we can start to calculate how accurate our seeding system is. So I could work out, after doing the item response theory, that if an examiner was to take all 43 seeds, I only based this on their first attempt at each seed, because sometimes they did them twice, then you get a reliability coefficient, if they were to do all 43, for marker inaccuracy of 0.79, which is not too bad. If we had a test with a probably a bit lower than we'd like for a test, but it's, you know, for something new like this, it's not appalling by any means. And once you analyse like this, you can start to answer interesting questions. You could start saying, well, okay, I've done an IRT analysis. I can now use that as a basis for standard setting. I could put seeds in a bookmark or levels of discrepancy in a bookmark and start saying, okay, this is okay, this is, I can see why they're that far away, and then, okay, this point here is where marking has started to become unacceptable, and we could set a standard. Once we've done that, we can then work out how many seeds do we need? How many seeds do we need to identify the poor markers? And we could work out which seeds work, which seeds don't. We can look at questions of, is it better to have harder seeds, so they make mistakes more often, and allow for more failures, and measure things that way. And if we were doing a standard test development problem, we wouldn't have all the items designed so that all the pupils get them all correct, which that wasn't a very good test. And in the same way in a seeding system, we might want to say, maybe we don't want all the markers to get all the seeds right all the time. Maybe we want them to get them wrong a bit, so we actually get a bit of measurement of how much discrepancy they have from the principal examiner. And if we do that, we actually get a better measure. We're not going to stop them. We're not going to say, we're not making it harder because we want to stop them more often. We want to make it harder so we get a better measurement and can make sure that we're stopping the right people. That's the idea. Okay. So to summarise, so I've got less detail on that, but that was another idea I had. So just to summarise, we've got two sources of decision-making. We've got these new processes that we understand, qualification, seeding, double marking, and we've got a lot of historical data which has now been collected. If you bring those two together, probability theory and decision theory, you actually come out with a coherent system for making decisions about how a quality assurance system works. And when you do that, you can make the system more accurate, or alternatively, you can keep it the same accuracy you have now, but actually make it less burdensome. And both of those, I think, are worthwhile ideas. Okay.
Well, thank you, Tom and Beth. I'm going to take a slightly different tack and talk about challenges of introducing new technologies. And one of the reasons for addressing this point is that I think that what you've heard in relation to addressing marking quality are some innovative ideas and new ways of looking at things. And Beth talked about a paradigm shift. And that's a phrase that I've used over the last few years because it's an area that I'm interested in. And you may or may not know my background, but as Paul said, I've been involved in general qualifications and examining since 1983. I've been through quite a number of government initiatives, GCSE development, national curriculum development, attainment targets, statements of attainment, all that sort of framework. I've spent many hours of my life involved in marking key stage 2 and 3 tests, organising systems, looking at marking quality, or the reverse of marking quality sometimes. And all that engagement. And the work that I did latterly at QCA before I moved to work with DRS was involved in looking at the application of new technologies in assessment. And it was a government-funded program under their Investor Save Budget program, which some of you may have come across in the past. And Helen actually was involved in that, if you remember. And the whole point of that was to see how we could use new technologies to improve exams. And I've seen electronic marking as important in that respect and the use of technology in that way because it does affect, in my view, a paradigm shift. It takes you out of a paper-driven world into an electronic world, and you can start to see the sorts of things that Beth and Tom were talking about. And what I want to do is just, in a few minutes, reflect upon that a little bit in terms of my past experience and current engagement. Now, if you don't know DRS, then we've been involved in examination assessment of one form or another for 40 years, and we operate in other time-critical businesses such as elections and censuses. So we tend to count things that have high value and people want to have right. And that's part of why we're in this business with electronic assessment. And so the key questions that I want to address and discuss briefly are about where, in this respect, should our priorities be placed? Just a little bit of what does new technologies mean? How important are the benefits of applying new technologies to exams? Where do the risks in this business fall? How do we recognise and understand the trade-offs that emerge? And is there a way forward from this point? So first, where should our priorities be placed? And what do I mean by this? Well, it's quite simple, really. Are we interested in the best outcomes for candidates? Or are we interested in having good systems? Or are we interested in both? And hence my intention to talk about trade-offs a little bit later. Now, I hesitate to quote Ofqual's regs, but I'm going to paraphrase them just a little bit. Apologies for those in the audience who know more about it than I do. But as part of the framework, Ofqual talks about having aims of learners getting the results that they deserve out of an assessment process. They also have a statement about qualifications that candidates receive counting both now and in the future. In other words, there's an outcome that's fair and there's an outcome that has currency from the process. And they want to ensure that awarding organisations have good systems in place and that the quality of marking is good. So, without the educational aspects being overlooked, then, how do we introduce new systems and how do we seek to maintain confidence in the outcomes? So if these are the aims and the outcomes that are wanted, having good systems in place and ensuring the quality of marking is good, how do we achieve that if we want to progress and implement innovation? So getting this balance in practice is slightly easier said than done, especially once systems become subject to change. And there can be a risk that the educational aspects are overlooked by those introducing new systems and those seeking to maintain confidence in the outcomes. And I'll say a bit more about this later. So in this respect, what constitutes new technologies? And interestingly, although the general perception of awarding bodies and examination authorities is that little has changed over many years, I'm sure that's not true here, of course, and with many others, new technologies have been introduced. Long before the National Lottery used OMR, then assessment bodies were using OMR to capture marks. And probably long before many people were using computers as a matter of course, awarding bodies were using computers. And the awarding body that I joined in 1983 had only just stopped using an outsourced bureau for processing its results. And in order to process its own results, we removed windows on the sixth floor of our building and had a crane, and we winched the computer up and installed it on the sixth floor of the building. And then we used our own computer. And you know what that was like. You couldn't go in there because only people who were allowed in there could go in there. But they were processing volume data in that respect, so they were making change and introducing innovation. But the focus then was to improve and streamline examination processing in an environment where more candidates were being examined year on year. Equipment was expensive and centralised, and schools, colleges and students did little different as individuals. They all behaved the same way. They interacted with the system, but behind the scenes it was being improved. Now, of course, applications and data processing sits in our pocket for our daily use. And in this context, new technologies should really be defined as the wider use of scalable solutions that enable improvements in both processes and outcomes. And scalable in this context, I think, is an important aspect. So some of these technologies have been around for quite some time, but have been the preserve of the specialists, but now can be accessed by a much wider community. In many cases, the constituent parts are tried and tested, but the combination of new contexts and the scale of implementation is where the challenges rest. The key part of the work that I did with QCA was to examine what changes could be made, the benefits that could be realised, and whether there were business cases that could be supported for introducing the changes. The focus on what could be done and how the change could be made and who would benefit was the most important part of the exercise, and where the greatest learning and experience was gained. not necessarily from the development of the technology or the new processes themselves. So, how important are the benefits of doing this? There is undoubtedly some excellent and innovative work being undertaken now in a number of fields of assessment, and I have no doubt that you're engaged with some of those yourselves. And you'll no doubt have heard about these sorts of things at previous conferences such as these, and you're going to hear about more in the future. However, there's a lot of further work to be done in some of these areas to take the achievement in small-scale exercises into mainstream assessments. And here, the pace of change is not dictated so much as by the nature of the developments themselves, but by the practical implementation on a large scale, as well as the sensitivity of the areas in which the change is being made. So, you know, how feasible is it to move some of these things into a scalable environment now? And what's of real interest to me is working on the equation of the magnitude of the benefits versus the spread of the benefits. How widely can they be made known and used? By that, I mean helping the transition from current state to future state through the use of interim solutions. Now, you'll know that my keen interest is in the benefits that the scanning and managing of images in assessment can bring. Now, I'm realistic enough to know that at some point in the future that's going to change and technology will overtake that. And that's right and proper once we've learned our lessons from implementation of these sorts of processes. But there is a case to be made for looking at these technologies now because benefits can be gained from them now. And it would seem a shame not to allow those benefits to be made available to as wide an audience as possible. So when considering the next steps in the use of technology, the industry should take into account not just the benefits themselves, but the size of the impact on all the students and candidates who might benefit. Now, where do the risks fall in moving forward in this area? Beth thought that my slide illustration here was going to have one of my colleagues suddenly have a nasty accident or an anvil fall on his head, but that's not really the case. So everyone in the room will know that sometime in the past, some notable failures in the use of technology in assessments have occurred. I'm sure you know that. And I'm sure this isn't just the province of us in the UK, and that others can cite examples internationally. Now, I think such failures provide an interesting cameo on a national body's view of risk and what can be done to mitigate against future failures of a similar kind. The engagement of the participating parties may have been achieved to an agreed standard, those engaged to make the change, but the execution of the changes tend to be where the issues arise. Getting the people involved at the start is fine, but making sure that it gets executed in the right way is harder. And clearly, national bodies that engage in making such changes do not want to be party to any such failure and tend to behave by attempting to pass off risks to the third party through the governance procedure of the programme of work and through contractual arrangements that are not possible to support for some organisations that have expertise to share. And in many cases, such passing of risk is not unreasonable, but has to be undertaken in the context where both parties engage fully in ensuring that the desired outcomes of the change are clear and that the contractual arrangements are not seen as the answer to poor specification, lack of appropriate expertise, and inability to make timely decisions. And those engaged in the process, all parties, should try to work with the industry, as change is only going to be driven successfully through working in partnership fostered by mutual respect. And one of the outcomes of that could be that organisations that have particular skills and abilities to help implement change are unable to participate because of the arrangements set in place for the facilitation of that change, the government and governance of it, and where the nature of the risk falls. And sometimes it's not always possible to have solutions fully developed to tackle some of the more difficult issues. I mean, you've heard what we've talked about in terms of a different framework for looking at marking quality. That's where it is at the present stage. Now, if we want to take that further and look at it in terms of a scalable solution nationally, how do we actually do that? And in what environment can we do that such that the risks of doing it are managed in a way that everybody engaged with it, those participating, those supplying, those governing it, can do so in a way that if the worst comes to the worst and a failure occurs, that can be managed. Because learning of this type actually only occurs through, not only occurs, but much learning only occurs through failures happening, trying it out and making progress in that way. So in short, all parties have to bear an element of the risk and to establish mechanisms to ensure that appropriate mitigation and contingencies are put in place if national schemes are to be implemented successfully, keeping in mind, of course, the best interests of the learners. And the other aspect to this, I think, is recognising and understanding the trade-offs in the equation. And part of my background has been project and programme management, and you'll probably all recognise that time-cost-quality type equation. And that's fairly immutable. If you want to do things better, they may take you longer or they may cost you more. Or if you don't want to pay so much, then you might reduce your quality and it might take you longer. All those factors have to be taken into account, and the trade-offs when considering the implementation of change of this sort. And in many traditional examination processes, trade-offs do occur. In the current paper-based driven that's still used, there are trade-offs, but they're not always readily apparent. Take, for example, two measures, one of completeness. In other words, we've finished everything that we're meant to have finished. Or we've got the marking to the appropriate quality. So we can say that the quality is right. And those are part of this sort of equation. So if the rules are you have to get everything done by X, can we also say that everything has been marked to the appropriate quality by X? Now, in the current environment, I'm not sure that you would know that absolutely. Those of you been involved in this for a long time will know that the physical processes are difficult to keep track of at times. And I'm sure that those of you who have run examinations have had to send the chaps around to somebody's house 2 days before results to get the scripts back because they've been sitting in their greenhouse unmarked. Or something of that sort. You know, these things happen. They're not readily apparent, but there are trade-offs in the traditional system. Now, move into the world that's supported by technology and electronic environment, then the processing of this becomes very much more apparent. You have much more information available much more readily. And going down the avenues that we've been discussing of marking quality also becomes very much more apparent and more readily. So you can see more, and therefore you're going to see more things going wrong because you've got access to it, whereas you didn't before. So does that mean that if you find out more because you have the ability to find out more, that it's worse than it was before? If what you're trying to do is improve quality and innovate and introduce change. And that's the environment that I think we need to look at and start to discuss, because there is a paradigm shift here. It's not just a paradigm shift of technology, it's a paradigm shift of how you view the current world in which qualifications and examinations are set, and the new world in which you might move if you want to do what is right for the outcomes of candidates, which is improve marking quality, increase confidence in the outcomes of qualifications, understand that you have met all the relevant measures, and see what is going on in a much better way. And I suppose my question in that respect is the current framework in which we're operating suited to that, and is it suited to allowing us to make change in a risky area where there almost inevitably is going to be failure, but allowing for it and enabling that change to take place so that we can progress and learn. So, just in conclusion, my suggestions, whatever systems are developed, we do need to make sure are robust and able to meet the needs of large-scale examinations, because that's what many of us are engaged in. It should be possible to support more extensive research into demonstrating the benefits of new approaches and how this can be made apparent at a level at which it's not just in a seminar in Cambridge on a Tuesday afternoon, where everybody says, that's very interesting. Well, you may or may not say that when you finish, but you know what I mean. And engaging with those who have expertise, and that's everybody in the industry, suppliers and national users, to create an environment where risk is shared appropriately and where new developments are phased in a way that manages risk and controls the impact of failures. So, thank you very much.
Well, thank you, folks, for an excellent set of presentations. It really complemented each other very well. I really like the idea, Beth, of the idea of a paradigm shift. I think it really captures where we are at the moment. We all know that when we have shifts, radical changes, we have huge risks. And, Graham, you outlined those very interestingly. And it's reassuring to know that we can confront some of those risks, Tom, and the empirical statistical approaches you talked about were fascinating. So thank you very much all for your fascinating presentations.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.